ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, my name is Nij, and I host Imagine This, a science podcast for curious kids and their grown-ups about the questions you've probably always pondered but never actually known the whole answer to. Like, how do magnets push and pull? Why is dew on everything in the morning? And how does sunscreen actually work? Find Imagine This on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there, welcome to The Minefield, where we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life, sometimes in fairly oblique ways, and I suspect today may be one of those things. Let's see how we go. Well, Lead Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. How are you doing, Scott?
You can't do oblique. This isn't oblique. This is an intravenous shot of nourishment and life-giving sustenance. This isn't...
I don't know. You can give an intravenous shot obliquely, can't you?
Well, that's never happened
to
me.
Just approaches from a certain angle.
Okay,
let me rephrase it. I think this could be one of these shows that is 1,000% intuitive in the head of Scott Stevens and very few other heads.
Yeah, that may well be the case.
Yeah, which is not a bad thing. I think in some ways that's the glory of this show, to the extent such glory exists. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm just warning the listener, this could be a journey.
Okay.
It'd be fun.
So can I begin with a proposition?
Sure.
And I'm fully aware that after this proposition, where it goes from there may well stem from a personal dislike. So
there are
strong feelings that I have about this conversation. I'm not unaware of the holes in those feelings or the limits of those feelings. So I'm not trying to impose anything on anybody, but I would like to open up a kind of space for self-critical exploration that may well yield sort of grassier, wonderful valleys upon which to romp. So there are two great genres in the book market. There are two genres that reign supreme in terms of sales. On the fiction side, it's romantasy. My wife is a huge romantasy reader.
Is that right? I didn't know this.
I just can't even.
I can't wait to see her again.
Our joke is, if it doesn't involve sex and it doesn't involve dragons, she's probably not interested. I'm at a loss. So what romantasy is to fiction, autobiography and memoir is to nonfiction.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay, go on, develop this.
Okay. And as soon as you think of it, it begins to make sense, doesn't it? Because you can understand why autobiography would prove so compelling to so many people. On the one hand, the autobiography is almost always going to be by someone who is relatively well known. Otherwise, why would they sign a book contract? Why would their book be mass marketed? People who are well-known, who are in the public eye in one form or another, will probably have lived lives that are in one respect or another fairly discreet. They are things that either because of PR or because of private interests or because of fiduciary or political duties, they simply will not have been able to bring out into the public. But then there's always the sense, isn't there, when you see them on television, you hear them on podcasts, there's a whole lot of backstory there, and you hope that by buying the memoir of the time of this politician in office or this actor's rise from, you know, ignominy to superstardom to their first Emmy to their Oscar, you discover all sorts of things along the way that have never been brought out into the public. But beneath both of those, Waleed, is the presumption that an autobiography is stitched together by an internal telos. We would not read this person's life if there wasn't a vein of meaning that runs all the way through it, which is not just a way of saying that there was something that there was inherently meaningful about these particular lives in a way that is maybe not meaningful about others, but rather these lives will have been significant by the time you read this book. So you know that, you know, even if it's a story of tragedy or of trauma, there's something sufficiently uplifting that will have happened in order to make this life worth reliving through the eyes of the author or, in many respects, the ghostwriter. And I think what that means usually for many people is that there's a degree of prurient interest that's often there with the reading of memoirs, the reading of biographies. But there's also a degree of you're searching for admiration. You're searching for inspiration. You're kind of thinking that if this person has overcome these things, if this life has become meaningful in these ways, then so too can my life be meaningful in certain ways. Maybe when I look back at things, things will have been meaningful in retrospect for me as
really?
Well.
Is that what you think? I was expecting you to go the other direction.
That, sure.
Their lives are meaningful because they are people with public meaning. My life, therefore, is not.
Sure. I think we're saying much the same thing. So you're though, saying that this person, this life isn't meaningful because they've accomplished something and therefore have become public. Their life is meaningful because the very public perception to which they've been granted has then instilled from without a kind of meaning from within. In other words, this is the equivalent of the imputation of honor within an honor and shame culture.
No, it could be either. My point is that I would have thought memoir, as you've described it, and I'm not sure I'm on board with how you've described it, but as you described it, I would have thought it just reinforces the difference between a life that is interesting and a life that is not. The life that is interesting tends to belong to people that are publicly known, whether it's because they're interesting people or interestingness was conferred upon them. And then there are people who are not that, and that is most of the readers. That's the separation I was expecting you to say, but you've gone in the opposite direction. You said that it's through reading memoir that the reader goes, oh, maybe my life is as interesting or has a purpose in the way that this one does.
Wouldn't you say that there's that hope that is nurtured? I mean, have you
ever... I would have thought that hope is just innate.
No, I don't.
I don't think... Really?
I don't think it's
innate. I think people like to believe that they lead lives that have a purpose and, I mean, or to use the minefield word, a telos.
Yeah.
Otherwise, people become very disillusioned and depressed at their own existence.
Yes, but I mean, one of the reasons, for instance, that it's so hard for us to talk about work and meaningful work in times like this and in a country like this is that so many workers struggle relentlessly, not just with the feeling of not being the narrators of their own story, not being agents within their own life, but they also struggle deeply with senses of futility, that there is this work that is being done, but it's not work that I can take pride in. It's not work that I can derive some sense of kind of substance or contribution from. In other words, it's work. This is the thing that fills my day, and yet I can't discern it as bearing, as having any kind of telos, any sense at the heart of it. This, I think, in many respects, well, it was the genius of a show like the U.S. version of The Office. It was the perfect coming together of the tediousness, the tedium with which we all live, with the overarching story of character development, of redemption, of the blossoming of relationships, of estrangement and coming together. In other words, it's the forms of everyday teleology, of everyday meaning, surrounded by... My God, what am I doing this for? Why am I spending so much time in a place like this doing work that won't amount to
anything? But that makes them thoroughly depressed, that thought. Right?
That's right.
And but so what then follows from that either is a capitulation to that depression. I don't use it in the clinical sense.
No.
A capitulation to that or a rehabilitation of one's purpose, either through finding things outside of work or perhaps even leaning more heavily on those things outside of work than those things themselves can bear. It could even be something as futile as, I don't know, belonging to a particular fandom or whatever, or reinfusing the drudgery of work with some kind of meaning or at least attempting to do that.
Yeah.
But either way, it seems to me that we are in the search of or we are clinging to, we need this idea that our lives have purpose, that they have telos. I'm not sure I disagree too fundamentally with you. I'm just querying whether or not the presence of memoir or autobiography is the thing that cultivates that.
No. But I think it's one of those things that lends a degree of attraction to it. I mean, sometimes it's simply prurience. I mean, my wife read Tara Westover's extraordinary memoir called Educated about her experience of being homeschooled in a kind of strange semi-millenarian community in Utah. She read it with a mixture of kind of horror and fascination because the entire thing was so far out of her own kind of sphere of imagining. It was prurience and strangeness that provided kind of the initial fascination. But then, you know, the very fact that you're reading this book means she escapes from this community. And she ends up going to Cambridge University, for goodness sake. And she ends up being supervised by David Runciman. So there are all sorts of things that what might begin with prurience ends up tapping into kind of meaning. And I think that desire for meaning really does provide this compelling point of attraction or fascination. What I find so interesting here, though, is that part of our presumption, I think, about autobiography or memoir even, and why we are attracted to it as opposed to, say, really, really compelling fictional narratives, even if those fictional narratives are based on, in some way or another, the author's own experience, is that we presume that there is a degree of truthfulness beneath it.
Well, it depends who it's from, actually.
Of course it is. And then you have the various forms of memoirs that have been kind of, that are deliberately ironic, that are playful, that are the mixture of character and, quote-unquote, in real life. But going back to something that we kind of explored a little bit, we sort of articulated on the mailbag episode we did recently, I can't help but feel that if I'm the narrator of my own story, and the story that I'm trying to tell is the story that is, in fact, mine, a story in which I play a central role, in which the people who also populate the story are planets that are caught within my gravitational pull, who are interesting to the reader only insofar as they are related to me. Can we really be certain that even if that story provides a kind of window onto the inner life or inner struggles of that person, can we really be sure of the truthfulness of the narration itself? Mm-hmm. In other words, who's to say that I am the best person to narrate my own story? I can narrate aspects of it. But can I really say the effect that my life has had on people around me? Surely that's part of my story. Can I really say, this is maybe what I intended to do, but this is in fact what I did? And these are the benefits, but this is also the rubble that I left behind. These are the people who, because of incautious words, I led to my own misunderstanding and possibly profound hurt to others. I don't think autobiographies are ever comparable, really, to biographies. That may seem like a really kind of stupid thing to say, but what it does get to the heart of is the extent to which we not just need others in order to narrate our lives truthfully, but we also need others, and we need to have a degree of clarity about our relationship with others in order to understand ourselves, precisely because of, when I am the author of my own narration, the likelihood of not just self-deception, but also of self-promotion is so great that it can have the effect of enfolding me within a self-reinforcing lie. I had this astonishing experience recently when I was asked to review a book of previously unpublished letters by the great French philosopher Simone Weil. Most of the books of hers that have been published are either drawn from essays that she's written or journal entries or letters that she's written to others. It's really clear to me, Willie, that when she was writing these letters to others, she had a sense of posterity. She had a sense that she wasn't just writing this to the person that she was addressing, but she was also writing this for readers later on. Some of the most remarkable kind of both spiritual and moral and philosophical works of the 20th century. I'm not saying that these things are somehow inauthentic. But then these letters that I had to review that she wrote to her parents are quite frankly pathetic. It's her unedited self. Hmm. It's her self-absorption. It's her kind of leaning on mommy and daddy to basically do everything for her and to come and save her in moments of really unwitting misadventure or just plain foolishness. It really shook me, Willie. It really did. And it made me think that there are all these forms of writing whereby we put forward our best version of ourselves precisely because we write with others in mind, and we want to ensure that the sense that people are left with is a sense that, okay, even if I have foibles, those foibles are more enduring than they are contemptible. There's something about that that I think for me has reinforced in so many different ways that the process, the ability to be able to tell the truth about oneself can almost never be left in one's own hands, but really do require either a form of writing that is radically decentering, that is radically, maybe not ego-renouncing, but that relativizes the centrality of the ego, but that also is dependent on the judgment of others, not just for the consequences of my actions, but really for also my understanding of what it is that really matters to me. This may be what I believe, but look at what my actions communicated.
If you just joined us, this is The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. Scott Stevens is the person who was just speaking then. My name is Waleed Ali, and I think I'm about to disagree with him.
Good.
I think your account makes sense, but I think it overlooks some important elements of it. One is autobiography, at least from the kinds of people you seem to have in mind as you're talking, is never the final or only word on a person's life and is never seen as such. And is therefore very rarely, I would say, regarded by audiences as the definitive truthful statement on the contents or meaning of a life. And in some ways, that's the purpose they fulfill if you're talking about certain kinds of autobiographers, where they might have lives that are endlessly discussed, endlessly torn apart, endlessly putty in the hands of journalists or gossip magazines or
PR operators.
Or political foes or cultural foes or whatever, right? What they're offering there is never seen, I don't think, as the clarifying truth that elides all else or excludes all else. It's additional context. It's additional information. It's the way that person sees what they've seen, read usually with the caveats that we know they are probably tending to their own reputation, etc. And so it's just another data point. And like all data points, and this is the second point I want to make, it comes with its limitations. I don't think I can accept the presumption at least I hear you to be making, that biography is more reliable necessarily. Because unless you are then going to interrogate the
limitations of the biographer.
Well, or the incentives of the biographer.
True.
Which seem to me to be, depending on the case, no more reliable.
Mm-hmm.
So why would I privilege that over autobiography? And then I think about other instances of autobiography, which perhaps you don't have in mind, but I've kind of had, for totally unrelated reasons, cause to be engaged with and think about a little bit lately. Consider the memoirs that are being written by at least one, there might be more as well, Israeli hostages that were taken on October 7th.
Mm-hmm.
Would you describe them in the same way as you've just described autobiography? Self-centered, I'm the main character, self-justifying, ultimately unengaged with how other people see me. Does that strike you as a meaningful or fair description of an autobiography like that? Or on the flip side, the autobiographies or the memoirs, which I find yield all kinds of fascinating insights about what life was like in either Ottoman or Mandate Palestine before World War II, sometimes before World War I as well, sometimes during World War I. Really interesting, rich stuff. Am I meant to look at that and go, yeah, but? Or do I take it in the way that a lot of historians do, actually, as a version of history that provides some data points that are to be interrogated alongside a whole lot of other data points, but which yield all sorts of fascinating insights about things that maybe have not been the normal concern of historians over the course of a saga like that, that might shed light on what interreligious or even interracial relationships were like at the ground level away from politics, or what life was like in the family home and how that changed as certain political developments or demographic changes arose or whatever. You see what I mean? That there are so many uses for this thing, and there are so many versions of a thing like memoir, and there are so many circumstances that seem to produce them, that I guess I just can't quite go along with that description. I'm alive to the concerns you're raising, right? Which is why I think whenever, and this is the ultimate case, right? Whenever a politician writes a memoir, it is received with cynicism.
Yes.
and some maybe even unfairly so, but it is received that way at the same time as it yields an interesting account of what was going on in the background behind what was discoverable through news coverage while this policy was developed or whatever. And then very often the people who are mentioned in that will weigh in and say, that's not what happened, or, you know, he's remembering it in a way that's very self-serving, let me tell you whatever. And then we end up in this world, which is a familiar world of claim and counterclaim, and we effectively discern some version of the truth from all of that. I don't think these things are lacking in value. I don't think these things can be written off as mere self-centeredness. The other thing is, and maybe this is just a dispositional, perhaps even it's a moral or an ethical disagreement between us, I am wary of the ethical move that says, I will privilege other people's account of me over my own in all circumstances.
Mm. Agreed.
I think it depends who those people are. I certainly think you shouldn't privilege your own view of yourself over those of others. But that relies, again, I'm here to draw on the terminology that exists within the Islamic tradition, that relies on people being capable of being mirrors to one another.
Hmm.
But that very much depends on the quality of the mirror. And, yeah, I don't know how far to go down this road without reviving a old disagreement between us about the nature of intention and the role of intention. But let me just say, your quite visceral concern, your fear of how something you intend one way might be seen another, has its place and is admirable, but I think might be overdetermining your view of memoir and autobiography.
Hmm. I don't fundamentally have any disagreement with anything that you just said. I think that is all perfectly put, Waleed. I don't think, and I didn't think I claimed, that autobiography is merely self-serving.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the interesting things, just to pick up this particular point about intention or about one's knowledge of oneself, is that who I am is not always clear to myself.
My question is it clearer to others?
And given the fact that we live in a universe surrounded by other egos who have their own intentions and their own designs and their own forms of self-justification, and that they are the narrators of their own stories, it may well be that I am caught in other people's gravitational orbit.
Yeah.
And by permitting myself to be drawn into their orbit, I'm giving way to yet another distortion.
Yeah, or their interpretation of me has far more to do with their own ego.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. But I think here's where we meet an interesting alternative. So the reason that I put things maybe a little bit more stridently than I ordinarily would is because of, in many respects, the cultural supremacy that is granted to forms of autobiography and memoir. With all the qualifications that you just gave, I'm not saying any of that should be discounted just because it's being narrated in the first person. But then I think about those examples, Waleed. And the best one that I can think of is, to my mind, one of the finest Australian books published in the last 5 years by Helen Elliott, who I know is a listener to this show. Hello, Helen. She's a wonderful critic and an essayist. She wrote this book called 11 Letters to You, which is a sequence of letters to people who have been determinatively important to her over the course of her life. And the role that she then plays as the narrator isn't as the center point of the book or the central perspective of the book. She describes her role in that book as being the hinge, the spine that allows all of these different stories to hold together in various beautiful ways. What it is, in other words, is it's a gesture not so much of her subjectivity, but rather of her gratitude to the decency, the kindness, the steadfastness, the forms of reprimand and reproof, but in various ways, the ways in which these largely invisible lives had a crucial role in determining and defining how she saw herself and the way that she sees the world. Something similar is going on, by the way, with Rachel Cusk's Outline trilogy, where it's a sort of version of what's sometimes called autofiction. So there is a real presence of the author, Rachel Cusk, in it. But the author takes shape only in outline by means of the various conversations that she's having with others. In other words, these are forms of deliberate and practiced attentiveness to the lives, the words, the intentions of others, not just the ways in which I am an agent within my life and in the lives of others, but also the extent to which I don't just act in the world, but I inhabit a world that is populated with words that I'm trying to get my hands around, with language that I'm trying to understand and use in a manner that is both moral, that is self-disclosive, but also that reveals myself, what there is to know about myself, properly to others and to myself. These are forms of, yes, autobiography, but it really is heterography. These are ways of telling the story of another and then understanding myself by means of this kind of deep and deeply morally charged attentiveness to others. And I think that's a form of writing that, to my mind, has a degree of not just authenticity, but also of moral significance, both to the reader, but also even more importantly, to the writer, that I think is often missed in our sometimes desire to ensure that we are narrating our own lives in a manner that others can know who, in fact, we really are.
You're listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. And as is traditional on this show, we have a guest. Scott.
For a conversation like this, we really had to find someone who is adept, who is lithe enough, who is able to contort himself in all sorts of rhetorical patterns.
What a metaphor this is.
Jedediah Evans is a lecturer in the discipline of English and writing at the University of Sydney. His own research focuses on arts and incarceration. He's got particular interest in the practice of life writing in prison. He's also associate editor of Paper Chain, which publishes the art and writing of incarcerated people. Jed, thank you so much for joining us on The Minefield.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I don't know how to respond to the...
Contort away!
I'm just thinking about dragon sex, actually, since which has now been 20 minutes on my mind, but it hasn't left me. I was thinking as you were speaking about being a reader of life stories, and in a similar way, being a reader or taking the role of a reader of other people's lives, which I think is really the function of a person who runs a writing workshop. And certainly in my case, where I'm teaching people who haven't had an opportunity to write about their lives or about themselves, perhaps ever before. And it got me thinking about maybe a better question or a better way into this disagreement or supposed disagreement is what kinds of memoir or autobiography encourage a sort of good or right or moral sort of reading of those. And I don't want to throw back a question to you both, but thinking about if there is a certain kind of mode or posture or invitation within those forms of writing, which are about a kind of self-revelation, which also encourage the reader themselves to reflect on their own lives in meaningful ways, as opposed to just sort of a prurient interest or, you know, just sort of discovering some of the small facts of a person who has a large life.
Look, I mean, this might seem both unbelievably obvious, but also, to my mind, there's just no surpassing it. The experience of reading Helen Garner's diaries has been astonishing for me. I mean, the number of times that I found myself stopped in my tracks, not because of the prurience, but because of the humanity of it. The lack of defensiveness of ego, the capacity to be, well, is it true? I don't know. It certainly seemed like the capacity for truthfulness with oneself, even to the point of what might seem to be self-condemnation. In other words, the sense that one is inhabiting a shared space with the writer rather than being led by the all-powerful, omnipotent narrator who is leading us through the inherent meaningfulness of a story within which they will be ultimately vindicated. That for me was almost a revelation.
Jed, can I ask you though, are we talking really about the difference here between memoir and other forms of nonfiction, or are we just talking about the difference between good writing and bad?
Yeah, I wondered that myself. Although I guess an interesting answer to that is you speak about Paper Chained, which is this journal of writing by people who spend time inside prison, and a lot of it is bad. A lot of what we publish or what makes it out in the magazine is bad in a kind of aesthetic sense. If you were sort of thinking, if I was thinking as a literary critic, or if I was editing a journal for the purpose of the most beautiful or the most coherent or the most illuminating, I probably wouldn't publish many of the things that end up inside that magazine. And so I don't think necessarily that bad memoir or bad writing, you know, if this is a distinction between simply good writing and bad writing, I don't think that that needs to exist necessarily. But the caveat for that is, and I was thinking this the whole time that you were speaking, is that I know the people whose lives I am reading. And that there is a kind of expectation or demand that is being made on me in reading what might be tedious or banal or sometimes sort of self-righteous, self-obfuscating work that is maybe not yet completed or sort of half-finished thoughts about a self. I can still enjoy and I can still see the kind of value and moral weight of that kind of work, because I know that it's a way for me to pay attention to a person. And then fundamentally, I do think, Waleed, following that moment, I have a kind of responsibility or a sort of a curatorial responsibility to help overlap the kind of life writing or the lives of those who are writing with writing or with work that I would think of as good, right? Or as clarifying or as illuminating. Like Helen Garner, I can think of people that I pick intentionally who would be considered memoirists or writers of autobiography, who I pick as models. And those models are rarely, if ever, doing the kind of teleological work of I started here, I ended here. They're much more fractured, frank, full of banality as well, but seeing what is kind of lovely or graced about banality. And so often it's the balance between paying attention to the way that we tell our story and tell our life story, but then equally thinking about ways that we might do that in a kind of perfectionist sense, you know, to take the Cavellian idea, how we might sort of learn from others who have learned how to tell their story where they're not the central character and where they're not that, as Scott was saying, they're not the sort of, or maybe this was you, Waleed, the planet or the sun around which other planets orbit.
Definitely, Scott.
Definitely, Scott. That does sound like him. Yeah. But yeah, I think for me, I can think of a kind of a series of writers that I would select or choose for people to read as a sort of corrective to more nefarious forms of self-censorship or, you know, kind of like taking hold of the narrative that we encounter. And I suspect that's like maybe Scott's primary gag reflex against autobiography is the kind that does that with intent, or maybe even worse, without kind of being aware of it.
I should be clear, I don't particularly like memoir. I just can't mount the objections to it that Scott has in a full-throated kind of way. Maybe that's wrong of me. Maybe actually the reason I don't like memoir, which I've never really figured out, is exactly the reason Scott has articulated. But I don't know. But when I think about, for example, the stuff you've spoken about publishing there, Jed, in Paper Chained, I think about that as something that would be enlightening to read, irrespective of to what extent you are the central planet in your own solar system, or irrespective of the extent to which it's well written or whatever, that there would be an inherent value in a person's own account of themselves in circumstances that are otherwise invisible to me.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the only thing it represents is their account of themselves, right, as opposed to themselves. So if you see what I mean? So even if the object of interest is the way they talk about themselves, there's something, it seems to me, really valuable in that. Now, that doesn't mean it's valuable in every instance with every person. It doesn't mean that every memoir should have been published or makes an important contribution to our shared life or anything like that. I think my problem is I can't diminish the value of memoir unless it meets these certain conditions as a plenary statement. I'm just constantly running into possibilities or cases where actually it would be valuable nonetheless, and I feel like you've just directed me to one.
That's all well put, Waleed. But can I put something to you and Jed perhaps to respond to?
Yeah.
Again, I don't think I was making a kind of plenary statement about the lack of value of autobiography as such. But I think what both of you have just reached for is something that gives an indication in the style of writing, not necessarily the quality, that lends one to believe that there is a moral presence here within the writing. I mean, I could give you 15 names. I don't think I'm going to. There are forms of writing, either in the form of kind of notebooks or of memoirs or forms of autofiction or even forms of fiction, that are so autobiographically infested and obsessed and corrupted that there's a kind of suffocating egocentrism there, but an attending obliviousness to others. I mean, one of the greatest writers who was also one of the worst writers, you could think about someone like Evelyn Waugh, talk about autobiographically kind of infested with his own inattentiveness to others, right through to, I mean, is there anything more banal than reading, say, the notebooks of someone like Martin Heidegger? It's just, it's astonishing to me. What I would ask the two of you is, what would need to be there to let you think, in the style of someone's writing, that there is moral presence there? And by moral presence, I mean there is a certain, yes, flawed, but nonetheless, there's an attentiveness of the moral reality of others within one's own life, and not just a desire for self-justification or self-exculpation.
I mean, I think that that is what you just described. I don't know if that can be framed in a kind of stylistic sense.
No, it's not.
That I can find that. I think there's a... C.S. Lewis has a book on an experiment in criticism where he describes the kinds of books that make us or that support us to become good readers, and that should be the distinction that we make between like highbrow and lowbrow literature. It's not so much whether Evelyn Waugh is a stylist of note, but whether or not it kind of encourages a certain kind of reading. And if the idea of reading memoir, and maybe this is what I would say for myself in my own reading, if the idea of that memoir reading is not only to see myself more clearly and to see the writer of that memoir more clearly, to pay attention, to acknowledge, but also to kind of be gifted with a new clarity of vision as such. You know, that so when I set down the book, I look at my children and I see them in a way that would have been impossible had I not just read the work of that writer. I think that for me, it's why I read this Catholic writer, Brian Doyle, who is sort of funny and as a stylist, quite over the top, you know, endless in some ways, but has a way of describing the banality and the kind of mystical grace in the midst of banality that leads me to think and see differently. And to that end, you know, he has a story that I share with men in prison. So it's not just, you know, I bring that in there and I say, hey, don't you love this as well? Isn't he fun and funny and all the rest of it? But he has a story that he writes, which he then received a letter from an incarcerated person that he then published alongside this story. As a kind of corrective to his own misunderstanding and his misapprehension of a person that he had quite explicitly in the context of the story hated. And I think there is those sorts of acts of humility, of clarity, of vision, that if there is a kind of good memoir, outside of what Waleed spoke about, outside of what a memoir might simply reveal about a kind of history or a moment in time or, you know, all of the kinds of things
that we might value it for. Or a deeply traumatic experience.
Oh, right. So, you know, the Diary of Anne Frank. I think outside of that, if I had to pick it as a genre that was capable of helping others do the work of self-illumination and self-reflection, which is probably the way that I most value it. So if I was to speak to Waleed about why he finds it tedious, maybe he just needs to read it for others. And that would be my kind of take on it, as if it's not giving me a way into the lives or communities of people that I hope to see better and love more coherently, then it sort of fails at the start. And when it is so shot through with self-deception and self at the center, I think it almost always fails.
There's also, I think, the wonderful example of someone who I know very, very well, a Christian theologian, a theological ethicist named Stanley Hauerwas. He wrote a type of memoir, a kind of theological, he described it as a theological memoir called Hannah's Child. And at the center of that story is the account of his life with, as a young academic, with his first wife, who was bipolar, a quite debilitating, very aggressive form. And one of the things that distinguishes, I think, his writing about her and his writing of the pain that he and their son experienced living together with her, he was aware at every turn that he had narrative power over her life, that no one was going to know who she was apart from his narration of her, and that her experience of him and their son was going to be something that would go largely unnarrated. And the effect of that awareness, even amid a kind of life of domestic pain, that awareness tempered the narration in a way that was not just, to my mind, stylistically important. And it wasn't in the form of kind of throwaway, but of course this was just my perspective. That would have been false. In the narration of one's life, something like that would have been false. But rather, it undergirt the entire account in a way that showed, I think, enough, not just moral presence, but also moral awareness of the power that one takes upon oneself in the process of narration, not just the power of self-assertion, but also the power of the narration of others. There was something there that I found not just instructive, but ethically really, really significant.
This is The Minefield on ABC Radio National, by the way. Waleed Ali's my name. Scott Stevens was just speaking there. Our guest today, Jedediah Evans, a lecturer in the discipline of English and writing at the University of Sydney. But as I hear you say that, Scott, the thing that I immediately think of is the same calculations are present in biography, in journalism.
It's true. Should be present.
Well, no, they are present, right? Even if you choose to ignore them.
Okay.
Do you know what
great.
I mean? So
yes, okay.
There are times where the reporter covering a story, either literally because the relevant person has died or can't speak or whatever, or for practical purposes because they are so confined in how they can respond or whatever, that they have total domination on how a particular event or a particular personality is narrated to the world.
That's true.
And that's why I'm just, I don't know, Jed, maybe I'm just asking you a question I've already asked you, but
sure.
To what extent are the things that we're trying to identify here particular or peculiar to autobiography, as opposed to concerns or traps or fault lines that exist through all writing and have to be navigated? And the extent to which they get thrown up depends not so much on the genre as the particular circumstances that surround that particular writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you're right. I suspect, again, maybe it is less a question of genre than, to go back to Scott's earlier point, about a kind of dominance of a particular kind of marketable commodity. And I suspect that maybe very few of us, you know, speaking here, are going to those shelves in a bookstore, if bookstores still exist, And picking them up and thinking herein lies something that is going to be an especially luminous view on a life well lived. I do think I'm feeling in the context of this conversation a sense or a sort of privileging of smaller stories of
that's true.
Maybe the thing that is ugly about autobiography is the way that they inflate unrealistically the sort of the scale and value of an individual life as distinct often from the lives that they're kind of in that large Venn diagram of life with, that they privilege the individual person, that they tell the sort of myth of the self-made person, even if, you know, even if they say in some sort of way as a nod to humility that, you know, other people got me here and it's in my acknowledgements page. I think that what we're talking about, in the same way that maybe I hadn't raised this, but we also privilege older, you know, the sort of the story of the person who has lived, which I think is also a kind of snobbery. Maybe this kind is a chronological snobbery, because many of the people that I work with, and certainly, Waleed, you were speaking about people who are writing from other kinds of conditions of confinement, who speak as people who have lived too much life. And so the story of a kind of moment or an instance is so capacious and so revealing. And so, I do think that there is, at least for me, a suspicion of stories that are told on a grand scale as opposed to stories that are grand in as much as they are small or modest or honest. And in that sense, that's not peculiar to autobiography. It's just maybe that what we like to market and what sells is the story of the huge, if they're in politics or a sports star or, you know, someone in film or wherever it is.
It's so interesting, though, you say that, because if that is what we're doing, that we're broadly more sympathetic towards the small story or the story of the smaller character, the smaller public figure, than the large one. Actually, a lot of the concerns Scott has raised would apply more to those sort of stories, wouldn't they? Because they're not subject to all kinds of counterclaims in public and so on. The story of the large figure, as I was kind of explaining before, it lands in a context of there being so much other material, so much discussion, so much light against which you can hold it to try to discern where it's self-serving, where it's true, and so on. So it seems like, to me, those stories actually commit fewer of the sins of autobiography that we've kind of been identifying in the abstract. But then when it comes to the actual autobiography that sits in our hands and the ones that we're prepared to pay heed to more or perhaps celebrate more or at least not attack in the same way, they tend to be the opposite of that. There's something very strange going on there.
But it does depend on the capacity to inhabit truthfully one's language.
Mm.
So something we've talked about on the show many, many times, the idea that language is simply a tool that I use to bring out that which is deep within me and to either express it or to impose it on somebody else. It's just not the way that language works. I mean, it can be the way that language works in certain debased or debauched forms, but the use of language is also, I mean, it can be a form of self-justification or self-assertion or of ego bolstering, but the attempt to frame an experience, an intense experience, or even a banal experience that at the heart of which lingers kind of something gracious, something almost miraculous, the desire to reach for language is a desire for truthfulness. It's a desire to capture something so that it's intelligible to me, not just to somebody else, but you can also...
But the truth can exist externally to the document, right?
Okay, sure. But sorry, it's a particular form of truthfulness, a truthfulness in the form of, say, self-understanding. But you can also imagine, Waleed and Jed, someone having a really, really intense experience, someone taken hostage, for instance, and narrating that experience in such a way that it is populated by monsters.
Yeah. Or politically... very self-serving.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And even though it's narrating an intensity of experience, it's also lacking the element of truthfulness and transparency to oneself that we would also want to hold up as the criteria for that. Which is not to say that the writing is worthless, but it's a particular form of writing that ends up concealing fully as much, I think, to the person doing the writing as it does reveal to people outside. Do you think that's a fair distinction, Jed?
It's funny because, you know, now we've made distinctions between, you know, the large and the small, the attempt to use language or to inhabit language truthfully or destructively, omittingly. And all I can think about is explicit examples of... So let me, there's a great, I would say great, so I'm framing it unfairly now because I'm sort of preemptively saying it's good, but there's a memoir called A Place to Stand by Jimmy Santiago Barca, who is a Chicano Apache man, incarcerated fairly in the sense that he committed a crime, but his story that he tells is the story of all of the conditions, all of the kind of necessary conditions of a life that leads near inevitably in the United States to time inside. And what makes it a miraculous story is it's not in the sense that he's always telling the truth. And he kind of speaks about performing a character in this because he's talking about himself as a young man and whether or not he ought to be generous to himself as an older man telling his story, like the extent to which he can express love to that person and whether that love is framed in the sort of omitting or at least in a kind of generosity of spirit towards behaviors that at the time might have just seemed far less, you know, conceivable and comprehensible to the young person. You know, that in writing about it, he is telling some lies, or at least he's telling the truth in a way that he could never have told in the moment of telling, that if there was witness or testimony to draw on, it would seem to totally be different. You know, if we read the police report or if we read the legal transcripts, they would say, well, this is not true. And yet, reading the memoir is an experience of reading something that is true in spite of that telling, because fundamentally it's a memoir about language, because he is illiterate before he goes to prison, properly and fully illiterate, and he becomes a poet on the inside. And then he becomes a person who, after that fact, lives a life committed to finding language and sharing language and giving the gift of language in those kinds of settings. And so there is something about that memoir that works its way kind of squeakily through all of these different distinctions, because it is a small life, and yet it's kind of framed in this very capacious, you know, way on mass incarceration. It is sometimes self-obfuscating with intent, but it's fundamentally, and maybe this to me is another way of clarifying the value of memoir, and to Waleed's point of how it relates to other forms of nonfiction, is that it's not ultimately about his life. It's about his life through language, which means that it's about language. And that, for me at least, when I am reading this kind of writing, there is that need to realize that life is not also just about kind of the events. You know, it's not only about a kind of true accounting of what happened, but it's also about all the other things that life is about, which may come to overawe the events of the life itself.
Wow. Well, having dealt with memoir, let's do romanticy. So, Jed, what do you think about good romanticy? We're out of time. I'm so sorry about that. Jed, thank you so much. It's been really enlightening speaking to you. So thank you very much for your contribution.
That's been a gift. Thank you.
The gift was all ours. Jedediah Evans, a lecturer, discipline of English and writing at the University of Sydney, associate editor of Paper Chained, which we've mentioned throughout this conversation. This is a publication that publishes the art and writing of incarcerated people, our guest for this week's edition of The Minefield. This episode is now over. You can catch us next week, of course, for our final new show of the year before Radio National Summer kicks in. Just a reminder, it is a not quite a book club episode. So if you haven't heard, we are looking at three murals by the 14th century Italian painter Ambrogio Lorenzetti. We will pop a link with some images of it on the Minefield website, or you can just go away and do an internet search for the allegory of good and bad government, and you'll be able to find something somewhere. So you have your homework. We'll see you next week to mark it. But that is it from us now. And in the meantime, you can listen to us anytime you like on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.